session number 30304.
Tenerife, Real 8. So was there much of a difference, obviously, between flying a single-engine biplane to flying a multi-engined monoplane? What were the main differences that you noticed at first?
In any aircraft which has more than one engine, the total weight is obviously much greater. The wingspan, the feeling of something larger is the first thing that strikes you when you first enter a multi-engine, and in this case Hansen, which of course is one of the small twin-engined aircraft. At least it is compared with the most aircraft the normal public sees these days. You begin to wonder how the controls are going to vary. I think that's probably the first thing that strikes you. As I've mentioned, instead of one control column, you've got the wheel. It doesn't occur to you immediately that the actual control column is not going to be waggled around, is going to stay upright. Well, not upright necessarily. I mean, it can go forward and back, we hope. How are you going to manage the two engines? And it depends really on which training aircraft, twin-engine training aircraft, you're on. The Oxford Airspeed Oxford, which I flew at Central Flying School, well, the wartime Central Flying School later on, and of course having flown quite about 600 or 700 hours by then, seemed to be quite a flimsy sort of thing compared with the jolly old Anson. So I don't think I would have had the same feeling about transferring from a small single-engine Tiger Moth to an Airspeed Oxford, but I think that's probably the only thing that can be said about the Oxford, as far as I'm concerned. The Anson immediately gave one a feeling of space and of more power. I don't just mean power from the engines, but the feeling that this was quite an important step in getting to an operational standard, because we knew that there were certain exercises simulating bombing and that kind of thing we should have to do. So unless there are details in the familiarization process which need further clarification, we could perhaps go on to the next stage in items such as single-engine flying, and or do you think we would put in some landing? Right, so let's deal with the takeoff and landing first. It's pretty straightforward. It might even be an obvious part of familiarization. You go through the action on the ground, in a similar way, open up sufficient power in order to get the aircraft moving, keep it straight, on the interwind, because we're still on an airfield rather than going along a runway. And the circuit procedure is exactly the same, in that 500 feet turn left, 500 more feet turn left. That part of it you're climbing at an airspeed, I forget what it was, probably 90 miles an hour, something like that, 100, until you turn left to at 1,000 feet to go on the downwind leg. And then you begin to realize a need to estimate how far you should go beyond being level with the edge of the airfield in order to be able to turn and make an approach according to the strength of the wind. As I mentioned earlier, if the wind is strong, obviously you're going to be blown further away from the airfield. But on a normal day, you soon get used to the distance that you need to allow beyond passing the edge of the airfield. Of course, all this is with the airfield down on your left. So when I say passing the edge of the airfield, I don't mean where you're going to pass it in order to land. I mean it's down way on your left, but the edge being where the runway starts. And similarly, at the end of your downwind leg, and allowing for the wind, you make another left-hand turn and start the descent by using the controls in the same way, applied in a different manner perhaps, I mean by the wheel rather than the moving the control column over to get the to control the ailerons, but making your descent so that again, looking for the wind speed, you arrive at a point suitable to make a left-hand turn again at 500 feet to make a final approach so that you're crossing the boundary of the airfield at a height of about 50 feet, between 30 and 50 feet, ready to approach and put down on the runway using the usual controls, the rudders. If a wing drops, as can happen, so that you lose the lift temporarily on that wing. Some aircraft respond better by using rudder rather than the aileron, trying to pick it up using the aileron. But that's the sort of thing that you'd expect on a turbulent day. Normally, it would be straight and just put us down without any problems.
With the Anson, would you have retracted the undercarriage on, say, a very quick circuit and bump, or would you keep it up?
That was one thing I was going to mention, actually. I was just checking what I've said. Having mentioned that it needs 160, 170 turns to get the wheels up, you really didn't have, if you were going to learn anything, which was the whole purpose of the flight, you wouldn't have time to mess about with the landing gear as well. The instructor wouldn't be very pleased if you were asking him to wind it up. But more than that, as he is not in the Anson cockpit, the instructor sits on the left. and the trainee pilot on the right. There isn't all that much room between them. As I remember, the winding gear for the landing wheels are the winding gear is on the left, so that the instructor anyway wouldn't be able to do his job and do the winding. I don't suppose he'd be very pleased to be asked to do it. The on the circuits and bumps, and for any short flight, it's entirely up to the pilot really to decide whether he took up the landing gear or not. Certainly, when one did get it up, it made quite a difference to the characteristics of the aircraft. It really flew very much better, as obviously anything would that didn't have a couple of rather heavy things hanging down below it. And you could get quite a reasonable cruising speed of 120 miles an hour if you got the undercarriage up, if you're on a long trip. Quite a pleasant aircraft to fly. I think the longest trip I did in an Anson would be about 7 hours, which, you know, you need a certain amount of comfort to do that. And obviously you need the undercarriage up for that kind of flying.
You mentioned circuits and bumps. What elements of the training would be involved with the instructor? What would you go on to after you got kind of familiar with the aircraft and you'd done the circuit, the landing, the takeoffs? What would be the kind of next sort of instruction you would have?
Without my logbook, which I lost, it's a bit difficult to remember the actual sequence. I think single-engine flying... The next one, after normal circuits and bumps, would be the precautionary approach and landing. That was nearly always applicable in the early stages of training on whatever. If there was going to be a problem in landing of any kind, and then you really ought to know how to do the precautionary approach. So that would be next. And we would choose, or the instructor would choose, some open space to put, first of all, to demonstrate, and then to put the trainee pilot in a position where he would need to apply what he was supposed to have learnt about that.
How did that differ with the Anson? Because obviously it's a larger aircraft, and you have prospects with an undercarriage. I'm thinking if you're not landing at an airfield as such,
yes.
What are the kind of, again, techniques, I suppose, for landing? If you have to make a precaution landing, say, away from the airfield, does that differ from the Tiger model?
Well, yes, in that you have the choice in an Anson of landing with wheels down or wheels up. In the Tiger Moth, you haven't. But that wouldn't make all that much difference so far as the Tiger Moth was concerned, because of its relatively short run, lower landing speed, less inertia to it. But there were occasions when you would make, particularly as Ansons were used quite a lot over the sea, differences between landing wheels up and landing wheels down. If you're going to put down on the water, on the sea or any other water for that matter, you would use wheels up if you had the time. I mean, it takes a little time to wind up the whole thing, you know. So you need a little more time to think about it, which you don't get But it depends entirely on the topography, the likely landing area. Whether you have a choice or not, it may just be that you've got to get down, come what may. And it's a difficult decision sometimes because in a belly landing, you wouldn't travel as far on the ground once you've got the aircraft down as you would if you had wheels down. So that if there was only a very small space and obstacles around and perhaps a steep approach, you would choose wheels up and do a real belly flop. Whereas if you had a reasonable run in your chosen landing spot, or whether it was chosen or not, you do have the brakes, of course, but it's always a matter of luck that what you think you see from the air is actually what's on the ground. One only has to go up to a height of, say, 100 feet and you begin to lose contour. There may be little humps. There may be things such as molehills. All that kind of thing puts you off when you're actually getting down there, which you can't see. So it's largely a matter of luck in that respect. But that would be one of the precautionary landing, one of the early techniques.
If you're going to make a belly flop, do you switch the engines off? Would it be a gliding approach so that the propeller's not moving while when you hit?
It's difficult to say. I think I've never had to do this, so I don't think very many pilots have. And if they had to, they probably wouldn't be able to say much about it. If it turned out to be not as good as expected. It's always a matter of whether there's going to be any likely damage to that particular aircraft. With the Hudson, for instance, if the wheels collapse, it's likely you're going to split a petrol tank on a belly flop or even a bad landing. With the Anson, that wasn't so so much in evidence because there was the wings would be relatively higher off the ground than with some aircraft, and on the assumption that most of the fuel would be in a part of the wing, that would always be a consideration. So it's difficult. It's one of those decisions which come when you're in the air and you've got to get the aircraft down.
So you mentioned obviously you do the kind of precautionary landings as the next kind of phase. What do you move on to then?
Single engine flying, which is really a matter of, well, in the first place, hoping that the one engine which is not being maligned, shall I say, is going to supply sufficient power. Obviously, at a suitable height to do this, because you're bound to lose some height. The Anson, of course, they were fixed props, fixed air screws, You couldn't feather them at all. And to feather an air screw is to turn it so that it has the least effect, or is least affected by the airflow. But the Anson screw would just continue to revolve by the force of the wind on it. It wouldn't give you any power. Obviously, you would need to get enough power from the remaining engine and as quickly as possible trim against that. Now, trimming an aircraft is rather like taking any material and making it a better shape, but still effective than the whole. Usually a small device which, let's say, on an aileron, that's the part of the wing which can go down and up, mostly down on most aircraft, has a little strip, perhaps no more than a foot in length, independently controlled, so that if you want to get to trim it so that the aileron is in the down position, you actually trim the trimming device so that it's pointing up, because the pressure of the air on that little piece is helping you to push the whole aileron down. So just as in single-engine flying, all the power is coming from one side. So you trim against that. If you don't, first of all, you put the controls in the position that you want them in order to counter this power, which is coming from, let us say, the right-hand side. If you don't do anything about it, if you don't apply the rudder, you don't apply the aileron to give more lift on the... Now, which wing would it be? Which wing would you want more lift on if all the power is coming from the right wing? Well, it would be the left wing, wouldn't it? You want the left wing to give more lift, so you would trim that so that it was pointing down, the trailing edge of the wing, the back of the wing, where the aileron is fixed, will be pointing down to increase the chord of the wing, the arc, to give you more lift. So you can trim that to help you to keep it in that position. Similarly with the rudder, there's a little rudder on lots of aircraft. You can see a little bit on the back of the rudder. You can trim that on most aircraft independently, so that it's a matter of, you might say, jumping to it, that an engine fails, the quicker you can rectify the matter, the less height you will have lost. And if you're lucky, you can trim it fairly quickly so that with a good aircraft, you're losing virtually no height, having lost an engine. Of course, you would always get rid of any stuff that you didn't need urgently. I've known aircraft on squadrons getting rid of even guns and all the rest in order to say, because, of course, over the sea, you may be a long way from land. Anyway, that rather diverts from this single-engine flying we're in. It's then a matter of keeping a very keen watch on the signs that the good engine is giving in terms of whether it's heating, overheating too much, if it's okay for fuel. Do you have any means of transferring, if you can't start the dud engine, if you can't start it, do you have any means of transferring fuel from the tank normally feeding, or tanks normally feeding the left engine, so that you have a lot more fuel for the right, because it's going to use a lot more fuel? That sort of thing, as a corollary to the initial reaction to the loss of an engine.
Would you land with one engine?
Oh yes, it's not. You wouldn't do it out of choice, but. I remember one chap when we were operating from Wick. He was, I forget how many miles out in the northwest approaches, and we followed behind him. We some distance behind it, we knew that the course that we were in touch, knew the course he was taking. And it was some hundreds of miles that he had to fly on one engine and had to land with it. But not that would be, of course. you would obviously warn the ground people that you were in this position, and it would be regarded as an emergency landing, so they'd have the fire crew out and all the rest of it, and it would have to be a gliding approach, and it's a very, very difficult decision to make, because the height at which you started your glide. And I've only known this happen on this one occasion, and this was where this was an airfield with a runway, as was commonplace, of course, after about 1941. But you'd obviously want to land on the runway, unless you've been instructed to land on the grass for some particular reason, because, for instance, grass is more generous in the bumps and so on than landing on a runway, and there could be less damage. The point I'm making is that on your approach, if you're flying using one engine only, and you have to come in on a glide, you need to you need to shut off power, let's put it this way, shut off power at a suitable height to allow you to maintain airspeed. Because otherwise you will stall in and the aircraft will just drop. And yet not cut the engine too far out, otherwise you won't make it onto the runway.